A busy Tuesday, May 14th, 2024, on Connecticut Today, where we talked about a growing debate over the reasons for WNBA player Caitlin Clark's anticipated influence in the league. Yankee Institute blogger Megan Portfolio stopped by with further commentary and an update on a controversial bill passed as the General Assembly wrapped up this year's session. We also checked in with State Senate GOP leader Steve Harding of Brookfield regarding a new report on health care costs in Connecticut.
As I've gotten older and tried to mature a little bit as I can as an adult and, you know, do as much critical thinking as I can on some things, I've tried to push myself, and I think that I've been somewhat successful in looking at things differently than I would have looked at them last week, last month, last year, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 32 years ago when I first started doing talk after segueing over from doing straight news and news anchoring. But we're in one of those situations again where I look at this story, big story that Connecticut is going to have a part of starting tonight, and I said to myself, you know, I think she's got a point there. And we're talking about a situation that will likely start tonight at the Mohegan Sun Arena when the Indiana Fever come in to take on the Connecticut Sun. And, of course, you know who plays on the Indiana Fever? Caitlin Clark, who for the last year and a half, 2 years, has been the dominant story in pretty much all of women's sports, not just women's college basketball or pro basketball, but likely in you know, in women's sports. And it is interesting because there are some writers there, some broadcasters, some columnists, and there's a piece written by a gentleman with the AP, Kyle Hightower, that I'll get to in just a moment. But there's a situation here evolving around Caitlin Clark, the interest being generated by her debut tonight, at least on the regular season pro level, and race. And race in sports. And I've kind of brought this up. I brought this up yesterday with Molly Yannity, professor from Quinnipiac. I brought this up a couple, 3 weeks or maybe a month ago when everybody was aghast how low the WNBA and how soft the relative salary structure is, you know, especially for rookies. And I was captivated and fascinated by this article that drew the same parallel I did. And please, this is not anything unique that I said, because a lot of people have been saying this. Let's rewind the tape back to 1979, if we can. I was 18 years old. I don't know, where were you in 1979, if you were around or not. And I was a freshman at Boston University, and one of the big sports highlights in that time was in the same year, the debut, as we have this year in the WNBA with Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese, the debut of one really good white basketball player in Larry Bird, went on to be a Hall of Famer, and one really good black basketball player, Irvin Magic Johnson, who went on to, of course, be a Hall of Famer. They became friends. They battled themselves through several NBA finals. There was a great HBO documentary about the relationship with between Larry Bird and Magic Johnson years ago. So you have kind of the same dynamic that's going to start tonight at the Mohegan Sun Arena in a sleepy little Uncasville out there. So that's good. You know how many people are going to be focused here on Connecticut? But it's interesting. The parallels are amazing. I mean, back in 1979, the NBA was not what it is today. It's not like, you know, the arenas were full, the ticket prices were, even for a regular season game, were hundreds of dollars a seat. Look, The NBA at the time, there was rumblings of the NBA folding or getting rid of a bunch of teams. I know that's hard to believe because it wasn't that long ago, but 1979, you had an NBA that in many arenas was playing to half houses. You had a rampant drug problem in the NBA. You had players fighting on the court a lot more than you would think. And again, eventually that got turned around. But, you know, you had a league largely dominated by black players at the time that a lot of white America didn't care about. And then came Larry Bird. Now, it's not like there weren't white stars in the NBA before that. And as one person points out, this Kyle Hightower in the AP points out, I mean, the logo of the NBA is still the image of a white guy, the great Jerry West, dribbling the basketball. And there's been rumblings to change that over the years, you know, whatever. But, you know, people finally stood up and took notice of the NBA a little more because, hey, here came this guy, this white guy from French Lick, Indiana. And the guy was a star in a league dominated by black players. And we may be seeing that again. Now, I know, you know, this Kyle Hightower piece has been shared on social media. Oh, everybody's a racist player. No. You're missing the point here. There's a difference between out-and-out raw racism and a racial aspect of something, which you can't deny. There's nothing wrong with admitting that there are some aspects of society, some, not all, but some aspects of society that center on race. We as human beings see the race. There's nothing wrong with that. We see, we are physical beings. We are sentient beings. We see what's out there. But there has been a little rumbling here from some of the established players in the WNBA, hey, black and white, saying, hey, everybody is falling in love all of a sudden because, you know, Caitlin Clark is a white girl from the Midwest. Now, you could push that off on racism. I'm not going to. I mean, why do you think Caitlin Clark is getting so much or so many of these endorsement deals already when she hasn't played a single second of a regular season game in the WNBA? There's a reason for that. She appeals to the Midwestern audience. Is race part of her appeal? Maybe. And again, I'm not saying this is racism. That's different. And my point here in opening with this is I just want to tell people, when you see that argument coming from some of the black WNBA players or some of the older white players like Diana Taurasi and Sue Bird, you know, they're going to have a little bit of an edge out for her. It's no different than when Larry Bird came in the league, except that Bird was an out-and-out assassin. He trash-talked with everybody, and he made guys just look dumb. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. And there are already people, I guess Charles Barkley was on a podcast the other day where he kind of urged the WNBA, hey, pump the brakes a little bit on the Caitlin Clark thing. This is a league. And I have said this before. This league has been around since 1997. This league has been around since 1997, and all of a sudden, weeks ago, a couple of months ago, you had all these people in the media and not hardly conservatives, all these people, these centrists and leftists in the media, oh my God, this salary structure is so horrible. Yeah, and now you're only noticing it because Caitlin Clark is white. Now that's good. Because eventually, what's that old phrase? A rising tide lifts all boats. And that's good. And now you finally have some black players suddenly, I wonder why, getting some endorsement deals at the same time Caitlin Clark comes in the league. Again, there's nothing wrong with that. But I got to tell you something. If you're out there and you don't think, now again, there's a difference between a racial aspect of something and out and out racism. I'm not talking about racism here. But a racial aspect of it, of course there is. And there's nothing wrong with understanding that. Same reason in music history. Yeah, there's the great British rock and rollers, some Americans too, but mainly the Brits, saying, well, hey, all these songs you love, these are black American blues songs that I'm playing here, but you only love it now because I'm white. And again, this all led into kind of a self-reckoning thing here. You see what I'm saying? So tonight, you know, it's going to be a magic time at the Mohegan Sun Arena, the Indiana Fever, coming into town as they take on the Connecticut Sun, national television streaming all over the place. But again, it's kind of interesting now that, and again, I understand there was a buildup watching Caitlin Clark in college. I get that. But this so parallels, and if you're about my age, if you're in your late 50s to early to mid 60s, you remember what a train wreck the NBA was in. Until Larry Bird came in, along with Magic Johnson, and you talk about a 180 in 2 or 3 years, where middle America, who basically was tied into the college game, suddenly started watching the NBA because of the hick from French Lick. And look what's happening now. You've got Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese coming in, and the exact same thing is about to happen. The late part, the closing hours of the General Assembly session last week were centered on this bill that I've had guests on, we've talked about on this show, kind of a last-minute, shifty, not totally above-board bill that would, to the joy of some and the dismay of others, pay state funding to some private sector workers who go on strike. You know, the idea is you weren't laid off, you're not getting unemployment, you made the decision to go on strike. Whether you were prodded to do that or not, that's not the issue here. Now, Governor Lamont issued his distaste for that bill last week, but he hasn't vetoed it yet. And I started thinking, can he go full Pontius Pilate here? That's a little biblical reference. And wash his hands of this and say, hey, don't look at me, man. Megan Portfolio's here. She's writing about this in the Hartford Portfolio blog, Yankee Institute. Megan, good afternoon, and how are you?
Good afternoon, sir. I'm doing well.
Is our esteemed governor going to, as I said a couple of seconds ago, go like Pontius Pilate, wash the hands here, use the antiseptic gel, and not touch this? I mean, he hasn't vetoed this yet, has he?
Oh, he's so unpredictable sometimes because, you know, sometimes he talks tough with, you know, the fiscal guardrails, and he stayed true to it, and he wasn't moving any of that, and he stayed strong. But then when it comes to big labor, and it's an election year, I don't know, Connecticut, the AFL-CIO is already sending around a petition for all the union members to sign. Mm-hmm. It's been going around, and then the SEIU had a tweet on there. You know, right after Lamont said he did not support it, they come out tweeting that we look forward to seeing Governor Lamont sign this important legislation. So, I don't know—is he going to cave to the pressure?
Are they going to break his knees? I mean, what does that mean? You know, jeez.
Wow. Oh, no worse. And then, you know how it works during election time with the unions.
Oh, come on. They're going to vote with these union threats. Of course they're going to vote for a Democrat. Stop this. Jeez. I'm going to take my ball and go home. No, you're not. You're not going to take your ball and go home. Oh, man. Now, and again, I do like what he said, Megan. You know, and kind of the year-end newser he did, the presser he did last week, number one, he didn't like it, but he did say something that I was cheering and a lot of people were saying is, hey, if you're going to do this, at least be upfront about it. Let's debate this, call it for what it is, state money, taxpayer money, no matter where it comes from, going to strikers. Now, that sounds good, but again, is he going to back down from this? Or maybe is that what the majority doesn't want, an open, you know, process on this?
Well, you know, we never know, really know what happens behind the scenes. But I mean, he was 100% or like 100% right.
Mm-hmm.
He said, if you want public dollars to support striking workers, have a vote up or down. And he is 100% right. This whole process, and I apologize for talking about it again, it has me livid. This is like the middle finger to transparency and the democratic process. They literally made up a bill which never even had public hearing, and then they're disguising it as this, oh, this is for low-income workers, a special slush fund account. We don't know what's going to happen with it. You know, how the money is going to be dispersed. There is no information. You've seen bills. Anytime the legislature has a state agency using taxpayer dollars,
mm-hmm.
those bills are so long and they are detailed. This is what you can do. This is what you can't do. This was a two-paragraph bill. And it was insulting because one of the proponents, Julie Kushner, was asked numerous times, is this for striking workers?
Yeah.
And she couldn't say yes. She would not say yes. All she would do is read the nonsense that was in the bill, just regurgitating it. And it was offensive. Senator Sampson from Wilkett asked her about three times, the same question worded just a little bit differently. Is this for striking workers? And she just kept regurgitating the same stuff. And then finally he said, well, can it be used for striking workers or something to that effect? And she gave him a one-word answer. And like, you knew what this was for, because the second the session ended, I've been getting inundated with emails from Working Families Party, all of the unions in support of this, all excited about it. It's like everyone was in on this scam, except for the people and the taxpayers. And it has me so angry that they would do that. What's to stop them going forward? Like, they did this once. Are they going to do it again? Just in, hey, here's a dummy bill. I'm going to throw whatever language in here for whatever constituent or special interest I want. Don't put it in front of the public. Don't have a public hearing, and we're going to vote on it. That is not how this is supposed to be done.
And again, and the guest is Megan Portfolio of Yankee Institute, the Hartford Portfolio blog. I mean, Megan, this is the kind of thing, and you're right, in the grand scheme of things, and this is what part of the talking points were on this, well, it's not that much money. Okay, in 20-something billion dollars a year for 2 years, it's not. But again, as my mother used to hammer into me, it's the principle of the thing. And, you know, I just hope the governor doesn't go soft on this. I mean, if you're going to, you know, if you're going to say you don't like it, just veto it and bring it back next year. But, man, if he goes ahead and says, well, I like unions, if he goes soft on this, I mean, it's going to be so disappointing, really. And what does that mean? You know, Megan, if he does go soft on this, does that mean he got hammered enough behind closed doors? Is he afraid of this? Did he get his arm twisted? I mean, that's what I'm wondering. If this happens, and again, we don't know what he's going to do.
Yeah, it hasn't even been assigned a public act number yet. That's like that. Once it gets voted out of the General Assembly, the first thing they do is assign a public act number, mm-hmm. and that has not happened. So there's still a little bit of time. Once that number happens, and it's put on online, then it gets sent over to the Secretary of the State's office. I don't know what they do, but they do something with it. And then it goes to the governor, and he's got 15 days to decide what he's going to do with it. And if he can veto it, hopefully that happens and it goes away. I'm sure it's going to come back next year. But if he does veto it, the General Assembly could still, you know, mm-hmm. bring everyone in
yeah.
and do their two-thirds majority to get it passed. But I don't know if they – I mean – they don't want to come in during their summer break, but it's just I'm the worst I've seen since being at Yankee Institute for 5 years. This is the worst bill process I have ever seen. I've seen the dummy bills, and they usually substitute it with language, with
yeah.
proposals or policies that we've already talked about. You know, they just move it from one bill to the next. I've seen that. I don't like it, but it happens. But the way they did this, they should be ashamed of themselves, and they owe the people an apology for how they did this. They had a bill. There was already a bill for striking workers. They could have amended that bill to have it come from the slush fund instead of it being paid to the unemployment insurance system. They could have done it that way, and they could have been transparent. They chose to do it this way, and they knew what they were doing. And that's what makes me so angry. This is like the most fired up I've been.
I was
ready for bed
that
night.
And all of a sudden
I hear this. I'm like, what?
Yeah, and I don't blame you, because I felt the same way, and I know some of the other hosts felt the same way. It's not, again, we can debate that. I know other states do it. I don't particularly think it's a good idea for their state to put their thumb on the scale. But again, Megan, like you say, it's the brazenness. People can read about this. You wrote about it. It's in the Connecticut Mirror. It's in the News Junkie. It's in the Current. You know, they just do something up front, and it's like, what are you going to do about it? That's what gets people, including my callers, angry here. And it gets me frustrated, too.
And honestly, if Lamont does sign this, I mean, you're just setting a precedence going forward that they can do whatever they want, basically, and we have no say. And that's not how this system works. And every single one of those lawmakers that did this, they do owe us an apology, and they need to promise, like, they will never, ever do this again. You do think there is a whole system that was set up by people way smarter than me, like 250 years ago, and it works fine. That's the system you're supposed to use. You don't just make things up and then make it a law without any input from us. The way they did it, they weren't upfront. They weren't transparent. It was obnoxious.
So again, Megan, before we wrap up here, explain to people what the process is now. The governor came out the other day, and he wouldn't use the word veto, but there are other publications in the state saying, well, he's going to veto it. And I'm saying, well, not really. We don't know that. And you illustrating your piece, what could happen here. So explain finally, as we wrap up here, how does the process work again?
So once it hits his desk, he has to take some form of an action, and it's either pass it, veto it, or do nothing. If he vetoes it, it could go back to the General Assembly, and they can vote on it. And hopefully he just vetoes it, and we can move on, and we'll see it next year, and they can do it the right way, and it could be transparent and call it a bill for striking workers, and we're going to use taxpayer dollars for it, and it'll go through the system, and if it passes, it passes. It doesn't, it doesn't. But what I would like to ask is that anyone who is interested in this bill to go to yankeeinstitute.org. And we have a take action button on the top of the page to ask the governor to veto the bill. It's super easy to do. So if any of your listeners are even half as outraged as I am, I encourage them to send a message over to the governor, because the proponents for this are probably inundating his mailbox as we speak. So he needs to hear the other side of it.
Okay, yankeeinstitute.org. Look for the take action button. Go there, and it'll explain. It'll walk you through it. Megan Portfolio, as usual. Megan, thank you. I know you're angry, so I don't know what you're...
No, session's over, so this is it.
No. I know, Megan, I still hear the anger in your voice. This is not good. So I know you're a runner. I don't know whether you're an herb tea person, whatever, but I think you need to decompress just a little bit more. I'm worried about you.
Yeah, I'm going to head off to CrossFit, maybe burn off some of my...
All right, Megan. Megan Portfolio, we'll chat next week. Thanks.
All right, bye.
All right, bye-bye. All right, the dust, the sand, whatever particulate you like floating in the air is still clearing from the just-wrapped-up legislative session in Hartford. Healthcare, though, seems to be one of those problems that everybody yells about being a problem, although I like to say I think our healthcare is pretty damn good. It's the insurance part of it and the money part of it and who pays and how much they pay that are the real problems here. Joining us right now to talk about a report that was just released from the state is Senate Republican leader Steve Harding of Brookfield. Steve, it's Paul here. Good afternoon. How are you?
Paul, always great to be on with you, and thank you very much for having me.
Are you all recovered, Steve? Have you fully hydrated yet? Have you got your electrolyte level back to where it should be? All set?
Getting there. Almost there. I would say by Thursday I'll be 100%.
Okay, that's good. A little more yoga, a little more herb tea, you'll be all set, right?
Yeah, get a couple of runs in me, and I'll be all right.
Nice. Now, Steve, I understand you and some other folks, Senator Summers, Senator Wong, are talking about a report here regarding health care that just came out. Brief us on this, please.
Yeah. So it was just a review of the cost as it relates to healthcare, and we saw that the previous year it rose as high as 6%, and then it rose again the last year by another 3.4%, and generally the goal or the benchmark is around 3.2. So you take a year where you were almost double what the goal or benchmark increase is. And then follow that up with another year, which is still a higher than normal mark for an increase in cost. And you calculate both of those years together, and you're looking at a really steep increase for healthcare costs in the state of Connecticut. And as you mentioned, it's, the healthcare system generally is fairly good here in Connecticut. I mean, there are issues here and there with, some hospital systems and some conglomerates and how they operate and the like. But for the most part, it's not so much the healthcare as it is the cost and how much the patients are paying for general healthcare here in Connecticut.
And you mentioned the benchmarking here, Steve. And I know previously in previous years that was kind of a little bit of a controversy. Is the benchmarking system working the way it should? Are we getting a good grasp on that or not?
I think that we have somewhat of a grasp on it, but I think there's more that can be done and should be looked at in the next legislative session. This should be an ongoing effort to address healthcare costs in our state. I mean, this is not something that we should just move on from after passing one piece of legislation and say all is well here and move on. I mean, this is going to be an ongoing investigation, an ongoing fight as legislators representing each of our constituents to ensure that we can help enact policies which make healthcare in Connecticut a little more affordable. But even more than that, I mean, we talk about overall affordability in the state of Connecticut. That has to be factored in too. This is not something that's going to go away in one day. I mean, Connecticut has raising costs and is more unaffordable than most states. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more that needs to be done, not only with healthcare, but all affordability levels and costs that we face here in Connecticut.
Yeah, one of the things, Steve, and the guest is Steve Harding, the state Republican Senate leader. Steve, one thing that drives me nuts, and I've vented on this show about it numerous times, is I guess this unwillingness or these roadblocks that have been set up for the state to at least try. And I'm a big let's try it guy, Steve. And if it doesn't work, let's backpedal on it, which I know is hardly ever done in Hartford. But let's try what some other states do, right? These association healthcare plans. And Steve, can we just, I mean, people say, no, we can't do this. No, 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 no. And it drives me nuts. Can we just see if they work? And I'm asking that rhetorically because I know a lot of people you deal with up there on this issue keep saying no. Explain that. What's going on there?
Yeah, Paul, I mean, here's the problem. I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of can we just see if it works. Here's the problem. You know what the reason it's not passing is? Because the folks that don't want it know it's going to work. And I hate to say it, but I really have to sum it up to that. It's nothing more than politics that has driven this plan away, because it is bipartisan. You have generally House Democrat members joining mostly Senate Republicans, but also House Republicans as well, and strongly supporting these efforts. You have CBAIA and all the small businesses coming into the fold saying, hey, this is a really good thing. Please pass this legislation to allow us to collaborate and create these association healthcare plans. I mean, and on top of that, the plan that was vetted this year and that was hoping to be raised out of the insurance committee this year had a lot of regulations surrounding it to ensure that the plans that were being created were viable, that would provide, well-regulated, well-structured, affordable, effective, and controlled health insurance for employees, many of which of small businesses. And as you know, Paul, not only is this good for healthcare costs and for healthcare in general in the state of Connecticut, this is good for economic development as well. Because what this effectively does is allows these smaller businesses to collaborate together, create associations, and then be that much more competitive when they look into the insurance plans that they can offer now collectively together, as opposed to these each individualized silos for each employer having their own insurance plan, which is just far less competitive, and the insurance companies are just not going to let them outweigh the risks for maybe an insurance plan that may only have four or five employees on it. So, I mean, this would allow these small businesses, which are the economic drivers for Connecticut, to compete with bigger business and with government, for that matter, to offer benefit packages that are equal or even better than what government or larger business here in Connecticut offers. It was a win-win across the board, a bipartisan win-win, and certain powers that be within the Democratic leadership did not want to see it move forward simply because their only solution that they want to see to affordable health care in their mind is a public option.
Yeah.
And they don't want to really have a discussion about anything else, and that's really unfortunate for the people of the state.
Yeah, Steve, did I read correctly? And Steve Harding is a guest. A couple more minutes with Steve. And Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, please, but did I read that? Yeah, that was it. And they were afraid that this would draw people out of the Obamacare marketplace and maybe into one of these association plans. So they're worried about the Obamacare two-part of it, right?
Yeah, they're worried about the market, they're worried about essentially the Obamacare plan, mm-hmm. And those individuals leaving that plan and moving on to these associated healthcare plans, because obviously they'd be able to provide better benefits, mm-hmm. at a better rate. It'd be a win-win for the individual. But I mean, really, what we're quabbling over and what they're upset over is people would be getting more affordable, better health care.
Can't do that.
Come on. I mean, yeah, and that's really, I hate to say it, but that's really what this is. And again, they want individuals that are in these particular situations to be, forced to mm-hmm. get into the subsidized market, that being Obamacare, or forced to enter into a public option, or force the state into enacting a public option, which really would be terrible for not only consumers, in my opinion, but obviously insurance companies as well. I think healthcare would be reduced. The efficiency, the affordability of healthcare would actually be reduced by public options, as opposed to this common sense, business friendly, bipartisan associated healthcare plan.
Of course. Steve Harding, State Senate Republican leader. Steve, thank you. Appreciate the time. Have a good rest of the week, and we'll
always
chat down
pleasure,
the road.
Paul.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate
you as well,
it.
My friend.
Yep. Steve Harding there.